We've all heard of flyover country, that big stretch of America that separates the East Coast from the West Coast. In 2020, some of the nation's biggest headlines have come from this usually quiet region. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, armed militia at the Michigan State House, a foiled kidnapping plot of the Michigan governor. But as important as these stories are, coverage of how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the Midwest has been scarce. Hi, I'm Sarah Cooper. Welcome to COVID Between the Coasts. With research and data resources from the University of Evansville, bilingual reporters from CAPASA Midwest, and public media storytellers spread across seven Midwestern states, we are bringing you the untold stories of how COVID-19 has impacted the lives and livelihoods of Midwesterners. These are the people we cover every day, and these are the pandemic stories you won't hear anywhere else. Thank you for listening. In episode one, multimedia journalist Juliana Dunphy talks with Midwesterners who physically experienced COVID and those whose livelihoods will never be the same because of the pandemic.
I found myself turning to the deep pits of social media. I was not necessarily looking for people who had posted their entire stories or anything of that sort, but rather I would actually turn to the comments and I would see the people who, again, weren't necessarily posting these long things, but maybe would share a little sentiment. They commented, they show that little snippet of like, I'm hurting too, something is going on for me too. And when I would start speaking to them, like you and I are talking, they would almost immediately break and say, I'm going through this, I'm going through that, like I'm hurting. And it was extremely powerful to be able to connect with a complete stranger. It really cuts a lot deeper than I initially thought. And so I wanted my podcast to truly encapsulate everyone's experience, though. It's tough to really do anything but let them speak, because I think that's just what this like national media was lacking. Nobody was just letting them talk, tell what they were going through.
I lost 8 people in a week.
It's much worse than what I thought it was gonna be.
I told her, I said, okay, I didn't even have my funeral planned and all of this stuff and my obituary written. And I said, here it all is.
You know, I think because our restaurants are named after our kids, I think it definitely hurts even more, you know, to have to close one of them.
This is Lisa Pettigrew and I am 56 years old and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I experienced the early days of COVID with the illness and just felt very alone.
I first spoke to Lisa, a COVID-19 victim who contracted the virus and fought through uniquely Midwestern struggles at the beginning of the pandemic. Confusion, distorted facts on social media, and a lack of testing availability. She began by walking me through her thoughts and experience in early March when first hearing of the virus.
My daughter was still in New York at the time at college, and she was going to come home for spring break. Then you start hearing like New York hotspot, Washington hotspot, nothing happening in the Midwest. And you're sort of naively thinking, well, maybe it just won't come here. You know, maybe the few planes that brought people into these coastal areas, we're just going to be lucky and isolated and we won't really have to worry about it.
She believes she knows how she contracted the virus.
Well, went to New York because by that time it was clear that our daughter's school was not going to stay open. So I said to her dad, he and I are divorced, but I said, we're going to go get her. And she was clearly not feeling well. And then we get in a car to drive for a day and a half all together. And she is just in the back seat shivering. By evening, that's when fever and chills hit for me. And so I'm thinking, okay, we all got her cold. Because you don't want to think you've got it. And I'm thinking the chances are pretty slim that we would get it. It's so early in it. And yes, we went to New York. And yes, we went to the hotspot. And if anybody would ask us, we'd be like, ooh, check.
Despite exhibiting all of the classic symptoms, the St. Paul area didn't have access to testing this early on in the pandemic, and therefore she was told not to come to the hospital.
So I think the second day in, when my fever was bad and my chills were bad, I just thought, I'm going to call the clinic just to let them know and also tell them, you know, I was just in New York. And they're saying, well, just stay home. There's nothing we can do. You can't be tested. You have to be seriously ill and need hospitalization. If you get to a point where you are having trouble breathing, give us a call. You know, you're thinking, I don't want it to get that bad. I don't want to wait that long.
Unable to get a test, see a doctor, or even go to the pharmacy, Lisa was left to have a difficult conversation with her daughter.
I told her, I said, okay, I didn't even have my funeral planned and all of this stuff and my obituary written. And I said, here it all is. I feel pretty crappy tonight. This thing could go quickly and I need you to know where everything is. And I love you very much. There were a couple nights in a row like that where I was kind of saying this, like, I feel really bad. And remember reading about people saying, oh, you know, my wife said she felt really bad. And by the morning she was gone. And I think, God, what if that's me? It was just very isolating, very much a feeling of I'm alone in this. If something bad happens, I'm going to be alone and there is no support out there. And I called the clinic again, and it seems like every time I called the clinic, they kind of had a reason for what I had. Finally, the task force said, okay, yes, testing is available. Antibody testing is available. And so I didn't get my antibody test until June. So then I felt like kind of vindicated, like, okay, I wasn't crazy. I wasn't making it up. But my purple ends of my fingertips weren't broken blood vessels. And they didn't even say, oh, take this or that. And I was on my own to deal with it, partly because they couldn't confirm that that's what I had.
Nancy Dean. I live in Apple Valley, Minnesota, and I'm 59 years old.
Nancy has been admitted to the hospital multiple times since contracting the virus in early July. She says she felt isolated and abandoned, even from inside the ER.
At the beginning, I actually said, you know what? This isn't that bad. I'm kind of glad that I got it. And now this is all it is. And I don't have to be as fearful. And then as the days went on and more symptoms came up, then I realized, oh dear, this is some serious stuff. And then by day 8, I was at the doctor's. And then it was detected that I had pneumonia. It was really just trying to keep my temperature down. I remember one time, you know, medicine wasn't doing it. And so we had a cold pack behind my neck and under both of my armpits. And I remember just sweating profusely. And when I looked back at that, of how many times I was sweating profusely and how my gown was just wet, not once did anyone ever put me in a new gown and then was, you know, in the hospital for 5 days. And I know without family being able to visit, it was really, really tough on my family. And a few times when my husband called, who's a pretty strong guy, he couldn't make it through the phone call without crying. But at 4:30 in the morning, they said, you know, we're sending you home. And the hospital I went to is at least 30 minutes from my house. So anyways, then the nurse came in, he started getting me ready. And I said, well, the doctor said I could stay here in this room until my ride got here. And he said, no, we have to get you going. We have other people in the ER that need this bed. He wheels me out. He places me in this outside like foyer area and just puts me in park and then leaves me there. And I was so sick still at this time. I sat in that wheelchair and I bawled. That whole experience in the ER was really awful.
Next, I spoke to Rochelle Riley. She hasn't contracted the virus, but in her role as Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture, She found herself experiencing the grief of an entire city as she planned the Belle Isle memorial event for COVID victims in August. Among those memorialized were some of her close friends.
I lost 8 people in a week, 8 friends.
She used her loss as fuel to do the strenuous work of planning the nation's first citywide memorial.
This first citywide memorial, and I was determined to do something that would honor the loved ones that we lost, honor and provide closure for the families, and do what the mayor told me to do, which was to make sure it was memorable. What I did was I planned a funeral, but I planned a funeral for 907 people the way I would plan it for one person.
She noted that while speaking with the victims' families, she realized how much they simply wanted to talk about their lost ones. She described these conversations as one of the most memorable parts of the process.
The most amazing thing for me is as I talk to families, I realize that in many cases, they just wanted to talk to somebody about their family member. They didn't have a chance to do a eulogy or to say those things that they wanted people to know. I had a conversation with a woman who just wanted me to know about her husband because they'd been married for like 5 decades. And she just, you know, wanted me to know who he still is for her.
I then turned to a different kind of victim. Alongside those who suffered the symptoms and who lost their loved ones are the men and women to have lost their way of life. I spoke to Chef Dave, who has worked in the restaurant industry for over 20 years, and due to the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic, was forced to close the doors of one of his beloved restaurants.
That was really tough. You know, my restaurants are named after my kid. So Liliana's is named after my kiddo Liliana. And then we opened Charlie's on Main in Oregon, Wisconsin, and that was named after my son, Charlie. And then we have a third kiddo, so we're opening a nonprofit, Pay What You Can restaurant, named after my son, John, called Little John's. You know, I think because our restaurants are named after our kids, I think it definitely hurts even more, you know, to have to close one of them. The most difficult part is that there was a possibility to maybe save our restaurant, because I am not alone in being a restaurateur that works every single day, you know, from wake until we fall asleep. And it is really hard to know that there are people who have tons of resources and lots of money and are just like, other people are fine. That's been really tough, is seeing people who have not understand what it's like for the people who are losing everything. I think there's a lot of anger, denial. I mean, like, go through every single stage, and I think I've hit it all. I think I'm at the point of just acceptance. There's no white knight coming. There's no PPP money coming. We're on our own, and it's up to everyone to just do our best to kind of tough out the storm. One of the things I've told everyone I know is pick the 3 restaurants you want to be here when this is all over and just eat there. Since the government isn't going to help, the only way we can make it is with customer support.
Well, my name is Jessica Van Dyke, and this is my 21st year teaching at Richland County High School in Olney, Illinois.
Jessica took me back to March when high school teachers across the nation were told to pack their things and take their teaching to Zoom.
I think it was a Thursday because we were getting ready to have like a spring break, and one of my coworkers said, "I bet we don't come back." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And sure enough, we got the message. It was really hard for the kids. They did not adjust well at all. The kids were really struggling to get homework done. I was with kids, you know, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. So that was a real struggle. Then we also had the issue where at the end, when it all was said and done, if you had a 30%, you passed. So here we are several months later, and we have kids taking class, and I think that they think that standard is still there, so they're not applying themselves like they really should.
Jessica explained that it's more than the hassle of online learning that puts some students at a disadvantage. It's economic inequality.
We are a rural community. The majority of our community is low income, so that really plays a role in it. Right now, we still have some kids that don't have internet access at home. We even have a teacher's kid, as a matter of fact, that has to, because they live so far out in the country, the internet is so spotty, she has to come in town and sit in her vehicle and try to get her homework done.
Jessica believes it is time for things to get back to normal.
I just think everyone wants to get back to reality and back to how it was, even whether it was good or bad, whatever, before. We just want to get back.
Lastly, I spoke to clinical psychologist Dr. Stacy Nye. She is the director of the psychology clinic at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Stacy emphasized the peculiar and extraordinary idea that the global nature of the pandemic should be oddly unifying.
But we're all COVID victims. Even those of us maybe who haven't gotten the virus, we've all been affected by it in some way or another. You know, I lost my mom this summer, not from COVID, but she was in an elderly home. And because of that, I wasn't able to see her. COVID robbed me of that. I'm sure everyone you talk to has a story like that or worse. I think the fact that this is global is really fascinating. It's not just happening like in your neighborhood or in your state or even just in your country. Like in the middle of April, to think that every single individual across the world was stuck in their house, you know? And, you know, we're very like very much in our heads all the time. And we're very narcissistic and egocentric. And we just think about our little lives. But when you stop and think about how small you are in the whole universe, you know, you get a little existential weirded out. Like it literally affected everyone.
In episode 2, WNIN journalist Steve Berger brings us stories of tragedy, resilience, and systemic failures in one of the Midwest's hardest hit cities.